What we're going to take a look at now is the career, and we're going to review this, by the way, via tape, the career of, or part of the career of Theodor Oberlander. Oberlander had been an SS officer and a key Galen functionary during the Second World War. He also became a minister, the Minister for Expelle, under the Adenauer government, and has become a dominant force in the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and the World Anti-Communist League. This by way of what we're going to do is review some of the information concerning Theodor Oberlander's career, and then we're going to take a look at the Expelle, the minister for which Theodor Oberlander was for a while. We'll also take a look at the circumstances concerning his exoneration of war crimes, and we're going to take a look at the Expelle organizations, how they functioned in Germany, how they functioned on behalf of the Nazi Party in Exile, the Naumann Group, how they served as a pretext for the Drang nach Osten, the push to the east that Adolf Hitler had advocated, and we're going to take a look ultimately at the German manifestation of liberation known as Befreiung in German, and we're going to take a look at this Third Reich political and psychological warfare technique, which became an American political and psychological warfare technique, ultimately a dominant force in American politics, and we're going to take a look at how that functioned, basically on behalf of a reconstituted German general staff, a reconstituted Third Reich political structure. Now again, I want to repeat that this is not to say that everybody in Germany is a Nazi or that there are not many fine and democratically minded Germans. In the book, The New Nazis and The New Germany and the Old Nazis, T.H. Tettens has an entire chapter devoted to the, quote, other Germany. He talks about that other Germany, but he was not optimistic about its ability ultimately to prevail over these reconstituted institutions. I, by the way, would characterize the United States in very much the same way. Most of our institutions at this point have turned fascist in my estimation. There is still another America, but I'm not optimistic about its chances either. In any event, we're going to turn now to Radio Free America number 14, the first of a two-part Radio Free America series dealing with the World Anti-Communist League, and we're going to review some information about the career of Theodor Oberlander. By the way, a slight correction, the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, or Nightingale Group, was the group commanded by Theodor Oberlander. It's not Nachtigall, it's Nachtigall, N-A-C-H-T-I-G-A-L-L. By the way, this program was recorded in January of 1986. The other voice you will hear is that of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. But turning again to Theodor Oberlander, key member of WACL and a fellow who was commanding a battalion composed of Turkic nationals who had been captured by the Germans and reformed into a unit fighting against the Soviet Union. Definitely, Theodor Oberlander had envisioned the use of the various ethnic nationalities of the Soviet Union as weapons against the Soviet Union and envisioned granting them equal ally status. This was something that most of the Germans did not want to do, and so it actually led to Oberlander's falling out of favor. But Oberlander had keyed the strategy, and this was used by Galen, of utilizing the various ethnic nationalities in the Soviet Union specifically as political allies and to be used in order to break up the USSR and defeat it militarily. I mention this because this is a key element of various aspects of the ABN today, the breakup of the Soviet Union, and the nationalist aspirations of the various ethnic nationalities were to be utilized by Oberlander. Reading from a book called Against Stalin and Hitler, written by a man named Wilfried Strickfeld, and that man is a key Galen aide, by the way. This book was copyright 1970, published in hardcover by the John Day Company. It's sort of a distorted book. It maintains that the Vlasov Army, which fought with Galen against Hitler, was basically also anti-Hitler. It wasn't. Although they weren't enamored of Hitler, they weren't fighting against him. They were fighting against the USSR, so he takes a little bit of leeway here with historical reality. However, the important part here is he describes Oberlander and his philosophy. A proposal of Zeitzler, approved by Hitler, ran, quote, "Locally raised formations are not to be of more than battalion strength. Remuneration should be of some kind or other in money or promises. But at the very moment when Hitler ruled out units of more than one battalion strength, there had come into being the Cossack Division under General von Panwitz, the Russian Defense Corps in Serbia under the emigre General Stefan, and other large formations as well. Professor Oberlander was commanding the so-called Mountaineers Regiment, composed of Caucasians which had served with distinction in the Southern Army Group. This I learned from a memorandum of Oberlander's, a copy of which reached me from the OKW, that's German Military High Command. Oberlander pressed for the setting up of Russian and Ukrainian liberation armies with the status of allies. We've already seen Oberlander working with Turkic nationals and nationalities from the Soviet Union. Now we're going to take a look at Oberlander working with Ukrainians as well.
Okay, this is from a Village Voice article, May 14, 1985, headline Reagan and the War Crimes Lobby. The article is by Joe Connison. He also wrote the first article, along with Murray Wass, that we read tonight on the broadcast. A leading figure among the rightist emigres is, they're talking again about the rightist emigres who are specifically, in this case, trying to smash the Office of Special Investigations, which is investigating World War II war criminals in the United States, many of whom are Eastern European emigres, many of whom are strongly affiliated with the Reagan administration, as we've been talking about tonight, among their supporters, not only Ronald Reagan, but his communications director, Pat Buchanan. A leading figure among the rightist emigres is Dr. Lev Dobryansky, Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas and chairman of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, the UCCA, and the Captive Nations Committee, Incorporated. Dobryansky, whose daughter Paula serves on the staff of the National Security Council, is also board chairman of a leading emigre publication, the Ukrainian Quarterly. Another is Yaroslav Stetsko, chairman of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, the ABN. We've been talking about them a lot tonight. And for a brief period in the summer of 1941, premier of the Independent Republic of the Ukraine. Stetsko, an elder statesman of the international far right, was received at the White House in July 1983 by the President and Vice President George Bush. He and Dobryansky also helped to create the World Anti-Communist League, the organizational haven for neo-Nazis, fascists, and anti-Semitic extremists from two dozen countries, formerly headed by racial theorist Roger Pearson. The spotty history of wartime Ukrainian nationalism is useful in understanding the anti-OSI campaign. OSI, of course, Office of Special Investigations, the people who are trying to deport these war criminals. It's useful in understanding the anti-OSI campaign in which Dobryansky, Stetsko, and their compatriots are implicated. For centuries, the believers in a separate Ukrainian state were frustrated by rulers from without, Polish, German, and Russian, and irritated by the presence on their soil of non-Ukrainians, principally Poles and Jews. These sentiments found expression in a variety of nationalist organizations, but the most important role during the war was played by the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, OUN, a fascistic outfit that freely employed terror and murder in its quest for a racially pure Ukrainian state. By 1940, after Hitler and Stalin divided the Ukraine between them, the OUN had split into two factions. The more active and radical, the OUNB, was identified by the last name of its would-be Führer, Stepan Bandera. His most trusted lieutenant was a young nationalist named Yaroslav Stetsko. Hitler's plan to invade the Soviet Union involved a campaign through the Ukraine, with the promised assistance of the OUN Bandera, whose chief patron in the Nazi regime was the real Führer's racial mentor, Alfred Rosenberg. But there was disagreement among the top Nazi leaders on the, quote, Ukrainian question. Heinrich Himmler and Martin Bormann, for example, insisted that Slavs were Untermenschen, lesser peoples whose only purpose on earth was to serve Aryan masters. To them, no Ukrainian state was tolerable. Rosenberg, himself a Baltic German, was more accommodating, and furthermore saw himself as the satrap of an eastern realm in a, quote, new Europe. OUN Bandera held its first and second congresses under Nazi auspices, and among its resolutions in 1941 was the following. Quote, the Jews in the Soviet Union are the most dependable underpinning of the ruling Bolshevist regime and an avant-garde of Muscovite imperialism in the Ukraine. The Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists opposes the Jews as a pillar of the Muscovite Bolshevist regime and at the same time is informing the mass of people that Moscow is the main enemy. Such was the ideological preparation for the Nazi invasion and the Holocaust that came in its wake. Simultaneously, the OUN Bandera was adopted by the Nazi spy apparatus, the Abwehr, to aid in the actual invasion both militarily and for intelligence purposes. Battalions of OUN Bandera volunteers under German command were formed both in occupied Poland, the Nachtigall or Nightingale Division, and in Austria, the Roland Division. Though the surviving adherents of the OUN Bandera deny it, historical evidence shows that the Ukrainian nationalists under Bandera reached for an agreement with the Nazis for the future control of the Ukraine. On June 30, 1941, the Nazi invasion reached Lvov, the capital of the Ukrainian province of Galicia, which was the OUN Bandera stronghold. That same evening, the OUN Bandera leaders who had traveled to Galicia with the Nazis declared a sovereign Ukrainian state, with Yaroslav Stetsko as, quote, premier. The division among the Nazis erupted in reaction to this declaration, and within 10 days, Stetsko was placed under honorary arrest by officers of the SS. Although this arrest is now portrayed as severe repression by the OUN Bandera, in fact, the Germans treated Bandera and his followers rather well, especially compared to the Jews and other victims of the final solution in Lvov, which was being carried out by Nazi Einsatzgruppen and Ukrainian, quote, militia, including many OUN Bandera men. Indeed, according to Alexander Dalin's authoritative German Rule in Russia, 1941-45, quote, during the following days of chaos, after the entry into Lvov, it became obvious to the Germans that Bandera's followers, including those in the Nachtigall Regiment, were displaying considerable initiative, conducting purges and pogroms.
Okay, now, remember the Nachtigall Regiment, and in particular, note the use of the OUN Bandera and its formation in the SS, along with other elements of the various ethnic nationalities that had aspired to carve up the Soviet Union, including, as we looked at, the Pan-Turkists. Now, recall that in Radio Free America numbers 1 and 2, we took a look at the OUN Bandera, the warfare that they carried on in Eastern Europe under SS auspices. We looked at them at considerable length at the tail end of Radio Free America number 1, and again, looked at the OUN Bandera's role in the SS and how later they jumped to the CIA along with the Galen organization. Now, the head of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, the Einsatzgruppen were the mobile killing units that followed right behind the regular Wehrmacht units in Germany. They simply dispatched the Jews, communists, and other people that the Nazis wanted to get rid of. Now, the Nachtigall Regiment composed largely of Ukrainian nationalists and fascists from the OUN Bandera. We'll tell you who was the head of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, referring to Theodor Oberländer and his wartime activities. At that time, Dr. Oberländer was an SS officer and a member of the notorious Abwehr. According to Die Zeit of Hamburg, he was an expert, quote, for the treatment of other races, unquote, and the political officer of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall. Okay, so Oberländer is commander of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall involving fascist Ukrainians. Oberlander's unit entered Lemberg on June 30th and remained in the city 6 days. According to Reitlinger and other sources, 7,000 people were killed, chiefly between July 2nd and 4th. Oberlander does not deny that he was in Lemberg these days, but says that during his stay, not a single shot was fired. And now after the close of World War II, let me tell you what I was reading from there. I was reading from a book called The New Germany and the Old Nazis, authored by a man named T.H. Tettens, a German anti-fascist, and it was published in hardcover by Random House Copyright in 1961. That's the section of the book I was just reading from. Let me read you some more, again, from The New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Tettens. After World War II, Dr. Theodor Oberländer went on to become a key cabinet minister under Dr. Adenauer's government. Recall in Radio Free America number 2, we looked at Adenauer's role as a Nazi functionary as the wartime mayor of Cologne. Now, Dr. Theodor Oberländer, SS man, commander of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, composed of Ukrainians, the man who worked with the ethnic Turks, goes on to become the cabinet minister for ex-Belay. Now, in Radio Free America number 2, we looked at how the ex-Belay office and that ministry in the West German government had basically become a vehicle for the agitation for Nazi expansion and the restoration of the 1937 borders of the Reich. And
the Ex-Palais group espoused an expanded Reich, which would involve such cities as Warsaw and Prague, a greatly expanded Germany. Theodor Oberlander becomes the head of this particular ministry. We also looked at this ministry in connection with Radio Free America number 11, and we're going to come back to it in Radio Free America number 15, because this group was very much involved with some of the people involved with the assassination of President Kennedy. Dr. Walter Becker is one of the main names, Gerhard Fry another. We looked at that in Radio Free America number 11, the Ex-Palais ministry and its role in the Kennedy assassination. We're going to come back to that in our next program. But again, Oberlander was head of that group, reading from the New Germany and the Old Nazis. Of all his cabinet ministers, the minister for Ex-Palais, Dr. Theodor Oberlander, caused the chancellor most chagrin. As a high Nazi official and officer of the SS, he was Reichsfuhrer of the German alliance in the East, Dr. Oberlander had used the Nazi press to demand the expulsion and extermination of the Slavic peoples and the rapid colonization of the vast conquered territories by the German master race. For years, German Democratic papers had charged Dr. Oberlander with packing the ranks of his ministry with former Nazis. Skipping down, the Ministry for Ex-Palais, once headed by Oberlander, is still known as a haven for former high-ranking Nazis. The personal assistant to the minister is today Dr. Wolfram, a former SS officer. The fanatical race propagandist Werner Wensky, ex-mayor of Lodz, serves as director of a department. Head of the press office, Dr. Schlichter, was a stormtroop leader. So again, Oberlander, head of the Ex-Palais office, that office a key vehicle for not only a refuge for Nazi war criminals, a vehicle for Nazi agitation, connected with the German elements who were coordinating with American fascist elements in the Kennedy assassination. Again, check that with Radio Free America number 11, Radio Free America 2, with more information about the Ex-Palais office, and we're coming back to it in our next show.
Okay, reading from a manuscript by Peter Dale Scott from the English Department.
And that concludes the taped segment from Radio Free America program number 14, that about the World War II career of Theodor Oberlander. Now, he was a key Galen functionary, and obviously an individual who went on to become a key cabinet member under Adenauer. He was forced to resign following the revelations concerning his participation in the massacre of the Jews in Lvov or Lemberg. It was known as Lemberg in Poland. When it became part of the Ukraine, it was known as Lvov. We're going to take a look now at the circumstances surrounding the exoneration of Theodor Oberlander. We're going to read now concerning the exoneration of Theodor Oberlander from a book called Inside the League, subheaded The Shocking Exposé of How Terrorists, Nazis, and Latin American Death Squads Have Infiltrated the World Anti-Communist League. This book was co-authored by Scott Anderson and John Lee Anderson, published in hardcover by Dodd, Mead & Company, copyright 1986. And of the circumstances surrounding Theodor Oberlander's acquittal, the two Andersons write as follows. Theodor Oberlander, by the way, O-B-E-R-L-A-N-D-E-R, you will also see it spelled L-A-E-N-D-E-R, beginning again. Theodor Oberlander, the German commander of the Ukrainian Nightingales, has continued his partnership with Yaroslav Stetsko through the World Anti-Communist League. A staunch Nazi, Oberlander joined the Nazi Party in 1933 and was made an honorary officer of the Nazi SD, or Gestapo, in 1936. The Ukrainians accused of carrying out many of the purges in the Lvov area in June of 1941 were under his command. After the war, Oberlander became a member of the Bundestag, controversial for his habit of carrying a loaded gun onto the assembly floor. He served as West German Minister of Refugee Affairs until 1960, when details of his wartime role became known and he was forced to resign. A year later, German prosecutors dropped the charges against him, citing, quote, lack of evidence, unquote, and stating that they had heard testimony from at least 150 Soviet citizens attesting to his innocence. What was not said was that most of these character witnesses were Ukrainian Nazi collaborators and members of the OUNB in exile. In other words, Oberlander was cleared largely on the testimony of men who had served under his wartime command. Oberlander's special relationship with Stetsko, each knowing intimate details of the crimes of the other, continues today. Oberlander is a high officer of the ABN's European Freedom Council and leads German delegations to World Anti-Communist League conferences. So again, the character witnesses for Theodor Oberland are the people who caused the German prosecutors to dismiss the charges for, quote, lack of evidence, unquote, were members of the OUNB group under his command. Recall last week we took a look at the reinstitution not only of Nazi jurists, but of much of the Third Reich's legal code in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. That undoubtedly played a role in these events. Recall, too, of Stefan Bandera, that he was assassinated the day that Lee Harvey Oswald defected to the Soviet Union, a, quote, defected, unquote, to the Soviet Union, and his assassination was linked by members of the ABN and the WACCFL, the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, the seed group for the World Anti-Communist League, which formally coalesced in 67. The assassination of Stefan Bandera was linked to the assassination of John Kennedy, this by way of helping to create the myth that communists had killed Kennedy, and this helped to effect the cover-up of John Kennedy's assassination, which we have looked at as the ultimate triumph of rollback or liberation theory in this country. That theory had its ultimate manifestation and worldwide triumph under the Reagan and Bush administrations. We're going to take a look now at the XPLA, and it was as Minister for XPLA that Oberlander became a cabinet member under Dr. Adenauer. Now, what we're going to be looking at, and we're returning again to the New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Tettens, we're going to take a look at the role of the Volksdeutsche in the Third Reich's military and civilian operations. Now, the Volksdeutsche were people of German descent and who identified very closely with the Third Reich, who were utilized by the Third Reich in a number of different capacities in some of the occupied territories. And later, we're going to take a look at the use of the XPLA as a propaganda device by the Nazi government in exile in Madrid, again connected to Dr. Werner Naumann. And then we're going to take a look at the policies of the Adenauer government and how they used the XPLA question to avoid diplomatic recognition of many of the countries in Eastern Europe, and how they used it for used the XPLA question to advocate the Befreiung or liberation of territories in the East, going all the way up to the Ural Mountains inside of the former Soviet Union. That has basically happened. Of the Volksdeutsche, T.H. Tettens writes as follows. The decisions of Yalta and Potsdam have been branded by the refugee leaders and their press as the, quote, greatest crime in history, unquote. However, these Nazis and nationalists keep silent about the crimes committed by large groups of the Volksdeutsche, the ethnic Germans who, as citizens of Poland and Czechoslovakia, acted disloyally toward their countries and conspired with Hitler in favor of a gross Deutschland. Skipping down. Like the Germans in Danzig, the huge majority of the Volksdeutsche had been fanatical followers of Hitler. They could hardly wait for the day when they received orders to make the Polish land Polenrein, or free of Poles. A few days before the war, Hitler had given the green light for ruthless mass murder. He told his commanding generals, quote, I have given orders to my Totenkopf formations, Death's Head SS, for the time being applicable only in the East, to bring unmerciful and pitiless death to every man, woman, and child of the Polish race, unquote. Thus, Poland was, quote, stricken from the list of nations, unquote, and the Polish inhabitants were exterminated by the millions. Gauleiter Forster, F-O-R-S-T-E-R, announced on November 26, 1939, quote, I have received orders to Germanize these provinces in the shortest possible time. In a few years, everything that can in any way be reminiscent of Poland will have disappeared, unquote. According to a report by the Polish government in exile, the Germans, quote, with the usual brutal vulgarity showed their mad hatred for everything Polish, unquote. As in Czechoslovakia, the Polish intelligentsia, the teachers, officials, officers, aristocrats, and priests were slaughtered by the tens of thousands. The Volksdeutsche, knowing every district and locality, furnished the lists of victims and assisted the Gestapo in carrying out the initial purge. During the first few months, 12 million Poles were driven from their homes and farms. All property was confiscated and passed into the hands of the German settlers. Millions of able-bodied men and women were shipped to slave labor camps either in Germany or in the conquered territories. Thousands of healthy young Polish girls were rounded up and sent to houses of prostitution in Germany or to military brothels behind the front. The rest of, quote, those unfortunate people were loaded into cattle cars and transported to the badly overcrowded General Government of Poland, the occupied rump state, where they were decimated by starvation and disease, unquote. By the way, the many quotes in the T.H. Tetten's book are footnoted. I'm not going to skip ahead of the footnotes. They are all from major German publications or other major papers. Continuing, motivated by race hatred and the obsession for Lebensraum, the Germans killed not only Jews, but Poles, Ukrainians, and Russians by the millions. According to official German figures, of the 55 million victims of World War II, 35 million non-combatants were killed in Eastern Europe alone as a, quote, result of the effects of war and occupation, unquote. Large groups of Sudeten Germans and Volksdeutsche in Poland played a vital role in the Hitler Holocaust. They filled the ranks of the SS, and they fought fanatically to Germanize the Slavic lands. It was in the light of this record that the Allies decided at Yalta and Potsdam to set the Oder-Neisse line as a final stop to Germany's century-old Drang nach Osten, or push to the east. Most Nazis had fled, and the rest of the plotters were sent home in order to end all further conspiracies. What else could the Allies have done? Had not the cry Heim ins Reich vibrated throughout Europe in the heyday of National Socialism? When in 1945 fate caught up with the Sudeten Germans and the Volksdeutsche, they were simply sent, quote, home to Germany, unquote. Heim, by the way, is Heim, H-E-I-M-I-N-S-R-E-I-C-H. Continuing with Tetten's account, what we're going to look at now is how the Expelle, again, the Volksdeutsche and the Sudeten Germans sent back home to Germany, played a role in the projected return to power of Germany as envisioned by the Naumann Group and the Nazi Party in exile that we've been looking at. Tetten's writes, soon after the end of World War II, the Germans started to use the Expelle question as a lever for a revision of the Yalta and Potsdam decision. Under the Allied occupation statute, the refugees were not permitted to organize. Nevertheless, they appeared in public as early as 1949 with a highly effective apparatus for mass propaganda, the refugee newspapers. Among them, the Volksbote in Munich and a Stimme der Vertriebenen in Hamburg began to agitate openly. Spellings, by the way, Volksbote, V-O-L-K-S-B-O-T-E. Die Stimme der Vertriebenen, D-I-E-S-T-I-M-M-E-D-E-R-V-E-R-T-R-I-E-B-E-N-E-N. Continuing, there is little doubt that the Expelle played an important part in the calculations of Dr. Naumann and his associates in Madrid. A secret circular letter issued in 1950 by the Nazi headquarters in Madrid stated, quote, the millions of Expelle must be regarded as a valuable trump card in our policy toward the restoration of German power. Last sentence again and again. This is coming directly from the Nazi Party in exile connected with Dr. Naumann. The millions of Expelle must be regarded as a valuable trump card in our policy toward the restoration of German power. The expulsion of 10 million German racial comrades was a blessing for the Reich. The Expelle strengthened the biological substance of our race, and from the beginning they became a valuable asset to our propaganda. The Expelle, discontented with their fate, infused a strong political dynamism in our demands. Very soon, we were able to drown out the noisy propaganda about German, quote, crimes, unquote, with our counter-accusation about the heinous misdeeds committed against 10 million German racial comrades. The distress of the refugees has created a common political ground among all Germans, regardless of political affiliation. The demand for the restitution of the stolen German territories keeps our political agitation alive. The militant elements among the refugees are working according to the best traditions of National Socialism, whereas the broad masses among the Expelle are kept close together in well-disciplined homeland organizations. The expulsion of millions of our racial comrades provides us with a heaven-sent opportunity to exacerbate the problem of the bleeding border and to hammer constantly for its revision. Last sentence again. By the way, the first sentence of the circular, the millions of Expelle must be regarded as a valuable trump card in our policy toward the restoration of German power. And the last sentence of the Nazi Party in Exile circular letter of 1950, the expulsion of millions of our racial comrades provides us with a heaven-sent opportunity to exacerbate the problem of the bleeding border and to hammer constantly for its revision. Bear in mind, too, that in our examination of The Nazis Go Underground from 1944 by Kurt Ries, we took a look at the role of the Auslandorganisation and its projected role as a vehicle for the Third Reich's going underground. Part of the Auslandorganisation would be the obviously the Sudeten Germans and the Volksdeutsche of Poland, principal elements in the XLA. Now, we've just taken a look at how the Nazi Party in exile in Madrid, again also projected by Kurt Ries in 1944, how they projected the use of the XLA question. What we're going to look at now is how the Adenauer government, obviously, as we've seen in past broadcasts, is very closely connected with the Nazi Party in exile, how the Adenauer government used the XLA question to push for, quote, liberation, unquote, or Befreiung, B-E-F-R-E-I-U-N-G. Now, recall, we're going to be looking at events in 1950, in the early 50s and mid-50s. It was during this period that rollback or liberation theory, perhaps we should refer to it now as Befreiung, was being introduced into the United States as a result of a CIA domestic operation called the Crusade for Freedom, or CFF. The CFF resulted in the evolution of liberation theory from a Third Reich psychological and political warfare technique developed by Alfred Rosenberg's Ostministerium into a dominant American psychological and political warfare technique, and ultimately into a dominant political element in the United States. It also resulted in the projection of many of these same Galen ABN-related elements into positions of leadership in some of the ethnic voting blocs and ethnic groups in the United States. Ultimately, that evolved into the Republican Heritage Groups Council, with many of these same Galen Third Reich ABN-related elements assuming a prominent position in the Republican Party proper. And recall, as we looked at in our examination of material from Blowback by Christopher Simpson, the liberation concept became a central element in the Republican 1952 campaign, both at the presidential and congressional levels, as a result of the activities of Arthur Bliss Lane, who was not only working for the Republican Party, but also for the CFF and related organizations at the same time. Now, in this same period, we are looking at the Adenauer government, again, a reconstituted Third Reich element for all intents and purposes, despite the historical disclaimers to the contrary. We're going to look at the Adenauer government functioning in a manner that obviously would be of great satisfaction to the Nazi Party in Madrid, and obviously we've taken a look at the evolution of that organization and its profound connections to the Adenauer government, and we're going to take a look now at liberation or Befreiung and how it functioned in the United States, basically as an extension of a major political and strategic concept of a reconstituted Reich. Again, as crazy or unpleasant as it might seem to the uninitiated, Germany was never denazified. This is not to say that all Germans are Nazis, or even most of them, but the institutions remained thoroughly Nazified, as we have seen in the last few weeks. Of liberation or Befreiung, and bear in mind that we're looking at events now in Germany that took place at the same time as liberation theory was becoming a dominant element in the United States as a result of the CFF. T.H. Tettens writes as follows. For years, there has been a tremendous propaganda drive to bring the more than 10 million refugees, quote, back to their homelands, unquote. This campaign has been carried on with the full support of the Adenauer government. Bonn has nourished the hope among the Germans that through a, quote, policy of strength, unquote, the lost territories in the East can be recovered. It was precisely this view which motivated the Adenauer government to pursue a policy of diplomatic non-recognition toward all East European states. In 1952 and 1953, Dr. Adenauer and his assistants openly advocated a program of liberation. The day after his election victory in 1953, the Chancellor, in a fiery speech in Bonn, demanded the befreiung of the territories in the East, quote, "But instead of reunification, let us talk rather of liberation, befreiung, the liberation of our brethren in slavery to the East. That is our aim, and that we shall achieve, but only with outside help." Last couple of sentences again. This is, again, a speech by Adenauer in 53. Eisenhower elected on a liberation platform in 52. Quote, "But instead of reunification, let us talk rather of liberation, befreiung, the liberation of our brethren in slavery to the East. That is our aim, and that we shall achieve, but only with outside help," unquote. Now recall that von Dönitz and Galen were looking to an alliance with the West before the end of World War II as a vehicle for restoring Germany's lost territories. We've taken a look at the continuation of the German high command going all the way on up through the appointment of Adolf Heusinger to the position of chairman of the NATO Permanent Military Committee. Obviously, they had plenty of outside help. That outside help was us. Continuing with Tetten's account. A year before that, at a press interview in Washington, the Chancellor's principal diplomatic assistant, State Secretary Walter Hallstein, H-A-L-L-S-T-E-I-N, defined the area to be liberated as reaching, quote, up to the Ural Mountains, unquote. At that time, the Germans dreamed of a third power bloc between America and the Soviet bloc of 550 million people, including a Slavic population of more than 200 million now living within the Soviet bloc. The liberation concept had been freely and frequently discussed at the time in the Rheinische Mercur. One of the Chancellor's staunchest supporters, Dr. Robert Ingrim, I-N-G-R-I-M, admonished the German politicians to discard this sterile concept of reunification and substitute for it a dynamic program of liberation. By the way, Rheinische Mercur, R-H-E-I-N-I-S-C-H-E-R, capital M-E-R-K-U-R. Last sentence again. One of the Chancellor's staunchest supporters, Dr. Robert Ingrim, admonished the German politicians to discard the sterile concept of reunification and substitute for it a dynamic program of liberation. Quote, "The task is not reunification, but the liberation of all that has been lost," unquote, stated Dr. Ingrim in a lead article. There remained little doubt that Bonn's liberation program envisioned the use of all possible means. It was Hitler's Drang nach Osten all over again. By the way, that means push to the east, D-R-A-N-G-N-A-C-H, capital O-S-T-E-N. Among the cities pinpointed for liberation by Dr. Ingrim were Warsaw, Prague, and Vienna. The unrestrained liberation propaganda of the early 50s created such unease in diplomatic quarters at Paris and London that Dr. Adenauer was soon compelled to renounce military force as a means to recover the lost territories. Since then, the new formula in the Chancellor's statements concerning reunification and revision of the Oder-Neisse line has become, quote, "in peace and freedom," unquote. However, apart from the Chancellor's official position, there is a very different cast to the speeches by other cabinet members before the huge refugee rallies. These revisionist overtones have not contributed toward dispelling the fears in the eastern capitals of a revengeful pan-Germanism. By the way, I would interject at this point, recall that in our discussion of the evolution of rollback or liberation theory in the United States, recall that many of these same Galen-related elements that were projected into the U.S. as a result of the Crusade for Freedom took the liberation concept and, quote, democratized it, unquote. And in other words, they dressed it up with traditional democratic-sounding American political language. We're seeing a similar thing happening in Germany when the advocation of, quote, liberation of a territory going up to the Ural Mountains was being bruited about by leaders of the, quote, new, unquote, Germany. Continuing with T.H. Tetten's account, being aware of the deep distrust in Warsaw and Prague, the ex-Belle leaders now speak quite diplomatically of the people's, quote, right to a homeland, unquote. They also claim the, quote, right to self-determination, unquote, as advocated by Woodrow Wilson in 1917. This, however, is viewed in the eastern capitals as a legalistic veil to cover up the old aggressive plans. So we're seeing not only rollback or liberation theory or befreiung being advocated by these reconstituted Third Reich elements, but we are seeing the dressing up of this language in order to ease fears in the other nations of Europe in a nice diplomatic or in a democratic-sounding terms, I should say, diplomatic also. Continuing now with T.H. Tetten's account, each year in the spring or early summer, the Sudeten Germans and the Expellees from Silesia, East Prussia, and Pomerania come together in rallies 200,000 to 500,000 strong, organized in the best Hitler tradition. Quote, "It has become customary," wrote the New York Herald Tribune correspondent Gaston Koblenz, C-O-B-L-E-N-T-Z, quote, "that a minister of the Adenauer government addresses each of the larger meetings and gives assurances that the cause is never being forgotten," unquote. According to the Tribune report, Dr. Adenauer, at a meeting of 250,000 refugees from Silesia, quote, "praised the Silesians for keeping alive the memory of their homeland," unquote. At another meeting, before 500,000 Sudeten Germans at Munich, Transport Minister Hans Christian Seebohm, S-E-E-B-O-H-M, suggested that, quote, "not only the Sudeten, but also Bohemia and Moravia, which form a large part of Czechoslovakia, should be linked to Germany in the future," unquote. Cabinet Minister Theodor Obelander once declared that the reconquest of the European East is a, quote, "German and European task," unquote. And I would interject that reconquest ultimately happened as a result of the Cold War policies pursued by the United States, to our own ultimate detriment, popular view to the contrary notwithstanding. And again, the significance of what I'm looking at here, we are in a position now to evaluate the extent to which the rollback or liberation theory being introduced into American society, along with many of these same Galen, Third Reich, ABN-related elements, was being introduced into American society at the same time as it was a major propaganda and political goal of reconstituted Third Reich elements in the, quote, new, unquote, Germany, and perhaps instead of liberation, we should use the proper term here, befreiung. And take a look again at the degree of coincidence between the projected viewpoints of the Nazi Party in exile in Madrid and the Adenauer government. And note that Adenauer stated that we will achieve that goal, but only with outside help. Well, boy, did he get the outside help. That outside help, of course, being us, U.S., the United States. Continuing with Tetten's account. The leaders of the various Landsmannschaften now show even less restraint in stating their revisionist viewpoints. By the way, L-A-N-D-S-M-A-N-N-S-C-H-A-F-T-E-N is Landsmannschaften. Dr. Rudolf Lojmann von Auen, the spokesman for the 3 million Sudeten Germans, said in a speech in 1957 that, quote, "The Allies should be prepared to use force to get these eastern territories restored to Germany," unquote. His name, by the way, Lodgman, L-O-D-G-M-A-N, von Auen, capital A-U-E-N. Continuing. The refugee leaders have stated quite openly that the ill-reputed Munich Pact, which led to the downfall of Czechoslovakia, quote, "still has international validity," unquote, that the borders of the Reich are those of 1939, including Austria, Danzig, and Memel, and that the Reich has a mission in the future, and that the geographic map of Eastern Europe will be changed as soon as West Germany is again established as a military factor in world affairs. Last sentence again. The refugee leaders have stated quite openly that the ill-reputed Munich Pact, which led to the downfall of Czechoslovakia, quote, "still has international validity," unquote, that the borders of the Reich are those of 1939, including Austria, Danzig, and Memel, and that the Reich has a mission in the future, and that the geographic map of Eastern Europe will be changed as soon as West Germany is again established as a military factor in world affairs. Well, of course, in the earlier part of this broadcast this evening, we took a look at the reestablishment of West Germany as a major military factor in world affairs. We took a look at the projections by von Dönitz and Galen before the end of the war that by allying with the West, they could regain Germany's lost territories. Well, we're going to continue to take a look at that alliance with the West, and obviously that has basically happened. Although, politically, East Germany has now been restored to what had been East and West Germany. Economically and politically, or in terms of political reunification, economically, all of Europe, including and especially the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, will ultimately, at some point, I can't say when, will be dominated by Germany. They're having, that is to say, the Germans are having serious economic problems with regard to reunification. However, they're already beginning, by the way, as I speak, on October 4th, 1992, to deport gypsies back to Romania, something which has an eerie ring to it. And as I said a couple of weeks ago, historically the Germans have always proved quite adept at disposing of unwanted population groups one way or another.